Some of the sisters, those with anti-technology leanings, remain in the good graces of the Emperor, and he has taken them back to Seleucus Secundus. The others, however, including Reverend Mother Rakella, have no place to go. I suggest that you provide them with sanctuary. Send them to Tupoli with the other exiles, or find a new place. The sisterhood will continue, and Venhold may find their skills extremely valuable, as I hope you have found me to be valuable. Absolutely. He brushed back his hair, already considering the benefits he might reap from this new development. Very well. Arrange for our spacing fleet to provide sanctuary to Rakella and to any other sister who requests it. They'll be in our debt. The sisterhood doesn't forget its debts, Cioba said, and surprised him by bending closer and giving him a kiss full on the lips before departing. In the mass evacuation, most of the sisters had already dispersed before a large ship from the Venhold spacing fleet arrived with an invitation from Sister Cioba. Bowing to her influence, Joseph Venport had let his wife provide sanctuary for Rakella and the sisters who had openly aligned themselves with her. The Reverend Mother seized the offer. When leaving Rossack, the women were allowed to take only a few items of clothing and personal articles, all of which were inspected. Though all available copies of the Ajar book had been destroyed, Rakella knew that many of her scattered missionary sisters had copies of the book, and 10 more Sister Mentats were undergoing special instruction at the Lampadis School, where they were memorizing the entire text. Emperor Salvador had done a good job of breaking up the sisterhood, and had outlawed many of the basic tenets of the order, but Rakella was still confident that the core of her teachings and the goals of the order would survive. She would make sure of it. Aboard the outward-bound space folder ship, guided by a mysterious and unseen navigator, Rakella felt pained to know that some of her most loyal sisters were discouraged and on their own, convinced that their outlawed order would never regroup. Many women had already returned to their own homeworlds if they could, or they went elsewhere to begin new lives. As soon as Rakella re-established her school, far from imperial oversight, she would begin to reach out and establish those contacts again. The bodies of the slaughtered Mentats and sorceresses had been cast to the jungles below so they could be re-assimilated into the Rossack ecosystem, including poor Carrie Marquis, who had been so young and helpful during the virulent Omnius plagues. It seemed like much longer ago than the actual decades that had passed since then. The breeding records and dismantled computers remained hidden in the isolated cenote, deep in the jungle. They were safe and intact, though the sisters were in exile. Once the Reverend Mother made a new home for these women, thanks to the assistance of Cioba and Joseph Fenport, the computers and records would be retrieved. First, she needed a new school. Joseph and his Mentat went out to the field of navigator tanks. Drago Roger remained stunned to have been rescued at all. Even after all my training on Lampadis, I learned a fundamental thing in the recent battle. The Mentat was intent on the central tank, mesmerized by the swirling spice gas. I learned that even the most detailed Mentat projections are fallible. Though I thought I had complete data, I could never have predicted that Norma Senva would come for us. Norma's enlarged face came close to one of the Plas viewing ports. She blinked. Prescience is a variable that can never be factored into Mentat calculations. Even prescience itself has many variables. A navigator uses spice to envision countless possible paths through the universe, and then must choose a safe one. There is rarely only one option. Still fuming, Joseph cut off further discussion. I am usually patient with your esoteric discussions, Norma, but right now we face a crisis. He glanced away from the field of navigators to the distant Kolhar spaceport where vessels came and went, cargo ships, passenger transports, and the armed vessels he had used in his original conquest of the Thanaris shipyards. He should have left the entire force there in a massive defensive posture. Kolhar is going to be a target, Joseph said. We have to defend this place and set up planetary shields like the ones that guarded Seleucus Secundus from thinking machine attacks. Our commercial ships must also be equipped with military-grade shielding, as well as the most advanced weaponry. The Mentat was silently compiling a list in his head. We have thousands of vessels in the Venhold spacing fleet, sir. Such an operation will require a massive expenditure and involve significant risk. Then we'll spend the money and take the risk. Make no mistake, this is war, and the planets of the Imperium will have to take sides and reap the consequences. We'll withdraw the services of our vessels from any planet that sides with the barbarians. The Mentat's brows drew together. Fenport Holdings will incur great financial losses as a result. If you lose this war, you're on the path to losing a great deal more. Perhaps everything. Joseph snapped, "We will not help any world that turns its back on reason and civilization. Where will the barbarians draw the line? Will they spurn medicine, even as they die? They have already ransacked and destroyed the original Sook school in Zimia." He shook his head. "Will they give up their power grid? Will they sacrifice heating and plumbing? Will they turn off the lights, leaving people to spend their evenings huddled around the glow of candlelight? Will they outlaw fire because it's too dangerous? Will they eat their meat raw?" Joseph laughed bitterly. "We'll see how enthusiastic the Half-Manford's followers are once they actually get what they want. Let them live like true primitives for a while, unable to communicate with other worlds, and watch how quickly they change their minds and fall apart." For a long time, Joseph had been intent on building the power of his family, on stockpiling wealth and expanding into as many markets as possible. But now that he had thrown down the gauntlet and stepped into a war greater than any he had previously imagined, he realized this was a clash of civilizations, a war between reason and superstition, between progress and barbarism. And Joseph would not go down without a fight. Rational humanity needed a champion. He drew strength from his newfound passion. "We can face these murderous bullies and expose them for what they are. We'll leave Manford to Rhonda without a leg to stand on." He paused, not intending to be humorous. "Metaphorically speaking, that is. Such a conflict could take years. Or decades," Drago warned. "So be it. We have Venhold's resources, our knowledge, and dedicated, clear-thinking individuals. We'll fight panic with intelligence. How can we possibly lose?" Are your principles the true foundation of your life, or window dressing? If you are unwilling to stand up and declare your beliefs for all to see and hear, they are not true beliefs, but mere pretensions. Manford Tarondo, address to the Landsrod League. After destroying the Thanaris shipyards, the remnants of Manford's Butlerian fleet went directly to Seleucus Secundus. Even though they had lost more than 60 ships to Venport and his technology lovers, and the remaining vessels were battered and war-scarred, the fleet made an imposing show as they descended to the Zimia spaceport. Manford's blood still ran hot from the battle, and he announced over all channels, to make certain everyone on Seleucia heard his news, "We have averted a catastrophe of machine resurgence and defeated a group of human traitors. Now we return to the capital of the Imperium for the support and accolades of the Landsrod League and every member of the government." They released carefully edited video images that showed the fearful extent of the reawakened robotic factories, how Joseph Venport had flouted the rules of sanity and decency. Immediately following the victory, the Butlerians had remained at Thanaris for the better part of a day to pummel the outpost and shipyards. Venport himself, however, had apparently escaped. Back at the shipyards, after experiencing the tycoon's treachery, Manford announced that no prisoners would be taken after all. Every single thinking machine collaborator was guilty of abominable crimes and deserved a death sentence. Following the constant bombardment from Butlerian warships, Thanaris was no more than a cloud of hot, spreading debris. And Manford was proud of it. If Emperor Salvador was wise, he would be proud of it as well. Manford had decided to stay on Seleucia for weeks, and months if necessary, until he had his chance to address the representatives of the Landsraad. Immediately upon arriving in the capital city, he sent out a citizen's call, formally petitioning the council for a new vote to replace the one that had been interrupted by the bomb threat. This time, Manford would accept no excuses. Considering that he had more than 140 battleships filled with supporters, his request received quick approval, and a vote was scheduled to take place in 2 weeks. Emperor Salvador himself strongly urged all Landsraad representatives and proxies to be there. By the time the date arrived, Manford's Butlerians were entrenched at the spaceport, flexing their muscle throughout Zimia, recruiting new followers and collecting petitions. When they strongly encouraged citizens to sign their names to the statement, very few people declined. On the morning of the scheduled vote, Manford pondered the best way to make an impressive entrance to the Landsraad Hall. 3 of his followers would carry banners of the inspirational martyrs to human freedom. Pale Raina Butler, beautiful Serena Butler, and her infant Mannion, who had been murdered by the demented robot Erasmus. Manford wore a loose shirt without adornment or medals, except for the insignia of a black fist clenched around a machine gear. Although he led the vast Butlerian movement, he thought of himself as a simple man, one of the people, and did not need to embellish himself with bric-a-brac. This time, rather than being carried on a palanquin, as he previously had when addressing the Landsraad Council, he chose to ride on Inari Idaho's shoulders. This appearance before the League nobles was, after all, a battle as crucial as the recent victory at Thanaris. At the appointed time, with more than 50,000 of his followers crowding the streets and the plaza around the Landsraad Hall, Manford positioned himself outside the great doors and ordered them to be flung open. Inari carried him proudly inside the gigantic hall, with Gilbertus Albans alongside and the 3 standard-bearers immediately behind them. As the legless man rode forward, he felt light-headed and energized with the blessings of Raina. Today would be a watershed in their millennial battle. His heart fell, however, when he saw that nearly half of the seats were empty. Again. "How can this be?" he said to Inari. He could feel the anger and tension as her shoulder muscles knotted like twisted driftwood, but Inari's face remained stoic. "Don't be disheartened. We know we are on the right side." He said to Gilbertus Albans, "Mentat, note who is missing. I'll want a complete list later." "I'm already working on it." Showing no dismay, Manford nudged Inari and she carried him into the speaking area. A dissatisfied muttering passed through the crowd, but he raised his voice, defying them to challenge him. "No more cowardly hiding behind bureaucratic procedures. Today is the day when you will go on record with what you believe. Today you must make a decision and declare yourselves on the side of righteousness, or an enemy of humanity's future." But as he looked at all the empty seats, he realized that many of the representatives were unofficially boycotting the meeting for their own protection, refusing to go on record either way. He should have known it would be difficult to rally them against Venport Holdings, even with the appalling images his followers had obtained at Thanaris. So much of the Imperium depended on Venhold ships and their strange navigators for travel, supplies, and commerce. Many of the absent representatives might already have gone to their homeworlds to set up defenses or form an active resistance against him. But Manford's people were more powerful and would respond with even greater vigor. He knew that many of his followers would die in the forthcoming struggle, but he would keep track of all their names and include them in volume after volume of the Book of Martyrs. Manford turned to the Imperial box. he had strongly encouraged the emperor to express his formal support for the measure. Reluctantly, Salvador stood in his private box to address the half-empty hall. "We all know the dangers of uncontrolled technology. I cannot help but be overjoyed that my Imperium has a chance to go back to simpler days, peaceful days, the way humans were naturally meant to live." He paused, as if gathering courage for his own statement. "I urge you to vote in support of Manfred Tarando's resolution." Then he sat down, as if trying to get out of view as quickly as possible. Manfred waited, but knew what the vote would ultimately show. Pressed into a corner, reminded of the consequences of intractability, the Landsrod representatives overwhelmingly voted to stand firm against any technology that could be construed as too sophisticated, too tempting, and too dangerous. When the resolution passed, he felt Inari relax beneath him, tension drained from her muscles like spilled water. But Manfred wasn't finished yet, and drew himself up as high as he could. "We must be specific, so that no one has any question. Emperor Salvador, I request that you immediately set up a committee of orthodoxy to watch over industries and advances, and quell any problem before it can become a danger. Every citizen of the Imperium must have a complete list of acceptable and unacceptable technology, and the government will need an enforcement arm. I volunteer the assistance of my people in these matters." Salvador's resistance had already been broken. Not surprisingly, he complied without further argument. Finished with his work for now, Manfred asked for adjournment of the meeting. Inari turned and followed the three standard bearers out of the Landsrod Hall. They stepped through the open doors to face the huge crowd of Butlerian supporters. He raised his hands high in a signal of victory, and the roaring cheers rolled over him. "Our movement will grow stronger now." Inari smiled up at him with a look of adoration. Manfred stared at the crowd and at the tall buildings. "We may have won today, but the real battle is just beginning. Humans are weak and don't like to live without their conveniences. We have to show them, by any means possible, that righteousness is far more important than comfort." Historians and scientists face in opposite directions. One looks to the past, the other to the future. The wise scientist, however, listens to historians and considers the past in order to create the most acceptable future. Ptolemy, Denali Notebooks. When Ptolemy learned of the massacre at Thanaris, the news only reinforced his nightmares. The wreck of his lab, the murder of his partner, and the fanatic Manfred spurning the gift of new legs. Because of the Butlerians, superstition, ignorance, and violence were becoming the norm in society. Rational people were already going into hiding, progress was stalling, and humanity was beginning to plunge into the abyss of a new dark age. For all of this, Ptolemy loathed Manfred Tarando more than anyone he had ever known. Throughout most of his life, Ptolemy had been a peaceful, innocuous man, following his own interests and paying little attention to outside political squabbles. Serena Butler's crusade against the thinking machines had ended decades before he was born, and the continued Butlerian paranoia about them served Manfred's purposes. Technology was only an imaginary enemy that Manfred used to rally his followers and build his own power structure. The recent purge of biological research on Tlulax was an extension of the Butlerian wish to eradicate all science. The attack on the Thanaris shipyards was an escalation of their senseless violence. And the recent vote in the Landsrod Hall was an outright challenge to civilized human beings. Instead of keeping the Butlerian radicals on the fringe, operating outside of legitimate government, the Landsrod resolution granted Manfred Tarando political standing and the explicit support of the Imperium. His extremism was being folded into the mainstream. Ptolemy felt sickened as he saw civilization crashing all around him. This could not be tolerated. Reasonable people had to fight back. In an imploring message, Director Vanport had urged all researchers on Denali to increase their efforts to defend against Manford's insidious assault, thus galvanizing the exiled scientists. It was time for the next step, Ptolemy decided. He requested a special meeting with Administrator Nafi in the Brain Preservation Lab, where the walls were lined with bubbling tanks. The expanded brains of failed navigators hung in nutrient fluids, cut off from sensory output, but kept alive. Ptolemy often spent hours regarding those disembodied brains, wondering what thoughts might be swirling through the gray matter. Now he turned to Nafi, who was harried by the pressures placed upon him, and said, "We have an opportunity, Administrator. We need to take extreme action to face an extreme threat." "I am always eager to hear your ideas, Ptolemy." Nafi seemed distracted. "They must be more than just ideas. I know you hate the Butlerians, as I do. Every researcher on Denali has been harmed by them, and I don't doubt that Joseph Vanport will authorize and even applaud what I propose. It will change everything." The administrator looked at him inquisitively. Gazing one last time at the uniform arrays of enhanced brains, Ptolemy turned. "Follow me." He led the Tluloxa administrator to the airtight hangar, where bright glow panels illuminated his trio of refurbished and fully functional Cymec walkers. A mere glance at the imposing machines still inspired a visceral fear in Ptolemy. Nafi's expression wavered between intimidation and admiration. "Three complete walkers." He walked closer, awed and nervous. "I knew you were working on the old artifacts, but I've found hundreds. I've studied them, and I understand them. And we don't need to be mere scavengers of old, defeated technology. We can build new walkers, more advanced machine forms with better armor and stronger weaponry. You think the old Cymex were fearsome? Wait until you see my new ones." Nafi continued to stare, then said in a very small voice, obviously afraid of the answer, "To what purpose?" "I have studied records from the time of Titans, the original source material, the memoirs of General Agamemnon, and before that, the Manifesto of Tlaloc. Back then, the human race had gone stagnant, grown weak. The Titans were ambitious, but in a certain sense they had altruistic motives as well, although their own aggressive personalities brought about their downfall." He turned away from the powerful walker, smiled at Nafi. "We can do better. With the enhanced brains in the experimental lab, and with improved technology, we can create a new set of Cymex. More powerful, more intelligent, and more adaptable than before. And they'll need someone to lead them. Possibly Joseph Vanport, if he is willing to undergo the radical surgery. If not, Administrator, you and I can be the first of the next generation of Cymex. With new Titans, we might manage to stave off the impending Dark Age." Both men thought of all the horrendous damage that Manford and his followers had caused. Nafi mused, "Yes, we could achieve a glorious victory. A new time of Titans." One of the greatest blessings in life is to discover your talent at a young age and do something productive with it. Reverend Mother Rachella Berto Anarul. Gilbertus Albans rode in an open, horse-drawn carriage that made its way slowly along the muddy streets of the Lampetus capital, leading other carriages in a victory parade. Beside him sat Manford Tarondo in a specially designed seat, waving to bystanders. The Butlerian leader and his followers were ecstatic with their triumphs at the Thanaris shipyards and the vote in the Lansrod Hall. For Gilbertus, both were Pyrrhic victories. He had regained Manford's trust by demonstrating to the Butlerians that he was no machine sympathizer. But he had to marshal his visible emotions. Even though the robot memory core had advised him to sacrifice the shipyards in order to maintain his reputation, he still felt he had somehow failed Erasmus. And he had hated being forced to defeat Drago Roget in a real and crucial battle. Gilbertus longed for a return to the days of stimulating intellectual debates and simulated games with his prize student. Here in the medieval-seeming city on Lampetus, he saw a hub of political and commercial activity, a melting pot of humanity on the sidewalks and paving stone streets. The crowds were cheering, with people hoisting placards that showed his own heroic image beside Manfred's. How quickly and easily their opinions changed. Blood-red and black Butlerian banners hung from buildings, fluttering in a cool morning breeze. Shivering in a gust of wind, Gilbertus pulled his jacket collar around his neck. The city was a hodgepodge of buildings built beneath a weather convergence zone, in which different storm systems often clashed overhead, giving the inhabitants drenching rain, lightning, thunder, and wind. But the local leaders were a hardy bunch, and they seemed to like the location. Weather sats would have helped, but Manford would never accept the technology. In contrast to the colorful celebrations, Gilbertus smelled sewage through the open carriage window. The stink would never have been so prevalent in a high-tech city, and certainly not on Corin under the management of the thinking machines. He looked out at the throng with mixed feelings. He wanted to improve civilization, promote the cause of human advancement. Despite the Butlerian fervor, that could not be done by discarding and destroying any device or technique that was even remotely connected with sophisticated technology. He couldn't wait to get back to Erasmus, who remained hidden, locked away, probably lonely, and most certainly bored. Gilbertus was worried to have been gone so long. Many Butlerians had died during the attack at Thanaris. If something ever happened to him, what would become of Erasmus? Though Gilbertus had lived for a very long time, he was still mortal. He needed to find a way to guarantee the safety of the independent robot, and soon. But what human, or group of humans, could possibly supervise such a strong personality? Manford turned away from the crowd with a stern look. "You look troubled, Mentat, on this great day." Gilbertus made himself smile and waved at the crowd. "They love you, too," Manford continued. "They respect you. The great service you did for our movement. You should stay here and work with me on our expanding efforts. Leave the school in the hands of someone else." Gilbertus had not wanted to be here in the first place, but Manford insisted that the people needed to see their heroes and adore them. "Thank you for saying that, sir, but my duties lie elsewhere. An important new student arrives this afternoon." "Ah, yes, Anna Carino. It's very good that she will be trained by someone of your moral caliber. And I am happy to have the Emperor's sister close at hand, right here on Lampetus, so that I can ensure her safety." Gilbertus fought to control his disturbed expression. Manford was considering Anna a hostage. "I understand she is troubled, her mind damaged by exposure to poison. But I will do what I can to help her through her difficulties. Perhaps Mentat techniques will prove beneficial." When the parade wound to its end, Gilbertus emerged from the carriage and Inari Idaho retrieved Manford. Increasingly, the headmaster was being compelled to have even closer ties with the leader of the movement. For more than an hour, forced to remain at the reception, Gilbertus shook hands with enthusiastic common people who gushed over him, praised him, patted him on the back. He posed for pictures with them, complimented them on their babies, and felt like the politician he did not want to be. With far less spectacle, Gilbertus went to meet the Emperor's sister when she arrived at the spaceport. Anna Carino wore a dazed expression as she was led along by two palace guards who appeared to be twins, ruddy, uniformed men who seemed ill at ease on Lampetus. dressed in a skirt and blouse that made her look like a young teen rather than a 21-year-old, Anna walked forward, her attention flitting to the sights around her. She took no notice of Gilbertus, but talked to herself in a constant muttering monologue. When Gilbertus introduced himself formally to her and received no response, one of the guards nodded to him. "Prince Roderick Carino sends you his sister. You are commanded to provide her all available remedy for her ailment." Gilbertus studied the young woman, listened to her recite a litany of diverse information, and after initial incomprehension, he realized that she was naming the Landsrod representatives and proxies from all of the thousands of planets in the Imperium. "I am impressed by your recall ability, Anna. It runs parallel with our studies here. A Mentat memorizes vast amounts of information and can recall it at will. Can you already do that? Are you able to come up with the data you want at any time?" When she didn't respond, he turned to the guards. "She may be quite a challenge, but there's a chance she could also be extremely successful, given her unique skills. With your permission, Headmaster, we will accompany the princess to your school. She is quite agitated and very clever. Take care not to let her get away."
"Yes, of course. We wouldn't want that."
Gilbertus stood beside Anna and listened while she recited long strings of numbers, sets of facts, memories, and the birth dates of everyone in the Carino Butler family tree. And he thought to himself, "Erasmus will find her fascinating." Sometimes the most attractive packages are the most dangerous. Reverend Mother Dorothea, First Notes from the Imperial Palace. Emperor Salvador Carino lounged on his throne of green crystal, watching as a new concubine sang and danced for him in the large audience chamber, a lovely young woman who had come recommended by Sister Dorothea. Her name was Angelina, and though Salvador had been reluctant to let himself get close to any of the women trained on Rossac, Dorothea intrigued him by hinting at other specialized bodily training some of the sisters underwent. In her first two nights of service as one of his concubines, Angelina had not disappointed him. Not at all. Though a long gown covered her from neck to ankles, Angelina showed she was extremely flexible, and he found her dance quite provocative. Every move reminded him of other moves she had demonstrated in the privacy of the bedchamber, causing Salvador to quickly forget about Empress Tabrina. As a formality, he had invited Tabrina to watch the lovely girl's dance performance, but she declined. In recent weeks, their relationship had been flat, without arguments or passion, or anything else for that matter. It was as if the two were not married at all and living in separate worlds. Lately, he'd been thinking of following the path of his father, letting his concubines bear children, and then designating the succession. Until learning of Reverend Mother Raquel's insidious scheme to cut off his bloodline, Salvador Carino had given little thought to babies, to raising sons or daughters. But now it seemed a point of honor to him. Any one of his other women would do just fine if the Empress failed to fulfill her duties. He leaned back on his throne. Salvador could not understand any of the words to Angelina's song and didn't care. She had a throaty voice that evoked bygone times and places he had seen in film books. Though he had asked her to dance here in order to lift his spirits, he finally waved her off with a quick brush of his hand through the air. She was a nice diversion, but he had so many other concerns. With a quick smile in response, she bowed submissively and hurried toward the open doorway. At least Angelina was obedient. Perhaps he would visit her again that evening. Or not. Although he was definitely pleased with her, the Emperor did have eight other concubines, and he didn't want to make Sister Dorothea feel too self-important. Dorothea stood near the throne now, looking very serious and loyal, though he detected pride in her expression. No doubt she was pleased that the Emperor liked her choice of concubine. Salvador's forces had completed the banishment of all members of the old sisterhood from Rossac. Reverend Mother Raquella and every sister, except the ones Dorothea approved, had also left the jungle world with little more than the clothing on their backs. He hoped Roderick had been correct in his suggestion to salvage some of the eerily trained sisters for imperial use, and was anxious to discover how Dorothea and her hand-picked followers could serve him. They would bear close watching. Prince Roderick stood beside the throne, ready to carry out his brother's commands. Through an open doorway, the Carino Emperor saw people milling about as they awaited an audience with him. Immense chandeliers hung overhead, and the walls were covered with heroic frescoes by the finest artists in the Imperium. None of the gaudy trappings interested him at the moment. All day long he'd been suffering from a bad headache that worried him greatly, now that he had no personal physician. Emperor Jules had been tormented with chronic migraines before being diagnosed with his brain tumor. After the attractive concubine flitted out of the audience chamber, Roderick got back to business. 8 people are seeking an audience, sire, including Dr. Waddies of the Sook School, a representative from Venport Holdings, and an attractive woman who wants to interview you for... Send Waddies in first. I want to talk with him about my headaches. He felt trapped without access to qualified physicians. He needed them, even though he didn't fully trust them. 3 other Sook doctors were on call in the palace, and he had ordered them confined to their quarters until further notice, unsure whether he dared to call on them again. Dr. Waddies was a tall, distinguished-looking man with dark, tanned skin. The new head administrator of the Sook School knew full well that Joma had been disgraced and removed from service, and thus far he'd been wise enough not to ask too many questions about what had happened to her. He bowed before the throne.
Sire, let me offer my most heartfelt apologies that Dr. Joma's service to you was unsatisfactory. She was quite secretive and acted independently in many ways. Now that we have begun to analyze her private records, we are discovering financial irregularities as well. You can be assured that we will investigate them thoroughly.
Waddies talked in a nervous rush. Because of public pronouncements, he knew for certain what Salvador had done to the sisters of Rossac, and he might know that Dr. Joma had been caught in her allied plot.
Please don't let this unfortunate incident reflect badly on our academic institution. Yes, yes.
Salvador rubbed his temples.
Your school's reputation has definitely been tarnished.
His head throbbed constantly, and he was sure a tumor must be growing in there, pressing behind his eyes, swelling inside his skull.
How would he ever survive without a competent physician?
Waddies rose to his feet, keeping his head bowed.
Under my leadership, we will do everything possible to regain our standing, and our new facility on Parmentier will work closely with the recently established Committee of Orthodoxy. We pledge to work within any guidelines you decide to set for us, Majesty.
Salvador regarded him with a sour and skeptical expression. The best way to regain your standing with me would be to guarantee the loyalty of any doctor assigned to touch my royal person. Joma was the highest-ranking Sook doctor. If she was caught trying to harm me, how can I trust any physician you provide? How can I be sure?
Waddies folded his hands together, bowed again. We have been studying the matter, sire, and we realize it is not a problem unique to an imperial patron. Many important personages fear schemes and assassins, and a patient is often completely vulnerable during treatment. Our psychological wing is developing a type of conditioning that will make a doctor utterly incapable of harming a specific person.
Standing beside the throne, Roderick interjected, "Conditioning? Do you mean programming? Like a machine? The Cymex added programming strictures to prevent Omnius from harming them." Waddies was alarmed by the comparison.
"Not like that. A special mental conditioning, costly and intensive, designed to protect an important patron, like yourself, sire."
"I am not merely an important patron. I am the Emperor."
"For you, sire, there will be the highest level of surety, imperial conditioning. an intensive and infallible loyalty verification program that taps deeply into the paretic consciousness, making an imprint that cannot be reversed under any circumstance. We are only in the test stages now, but the results are most promising.
Roderick whispered advice in Salvador's ear, after which the Emperor turned to the Reverend Mother, who waited near the throne. So, Sister Dorothea, you have demonstrated a reliable intuition as to truth or falsehood. Does the doctor's plan sound plausible to you? As far as you can tell, is he speaking the truth? The nervous doctor squirmed under scrutiny. Presently, Dorothea looked up at Salvador and said, I believe such conditioning is possible, and I sense none of the indicators that he is lying. Again, Roderick whispered advice, this time recommending that there would need to be layers of additional testing to be conducted here on Seleucus Secundus, so that the Carinos could be completely assured of loyal physicians. Finally, the Emperor nodded and said, Very well, Wadis. You may proceed with the program. I require a fully conditioned physician as soon as possible. From somewhere, the doctor found his courage. Thank you, sire, but it is only a very limited test program at this point, and we will need additional funding. Salvador brushed him aside. See the Imperial Treasurer. Roderick, draft the appropriate payment authorization. Thank you, sire. Wadis bowed and hurried away. Ironically, as soon as the Souk doctor departed, the Emperor realized that his headache had faded. Your exalted Highness, my sisters and I are grateful for the opportunity you extended in inviting us here. I would like to volunteer my services more frequently as one skilled in detecting falsehoods. Sire, if you allow me to stand near your throne during imperial audiences, I will prove myself extremely useful to you. But can I trust you? Isn't that the question, Dorothea? I want to trust you, just as I want to trust my doctors. But bad things have happened, things that give me pause. She didn't waver as she looked at him. Allow me to demonstrate my talents, sire, and I promise you will not be disappointed. Roderick broke in. Perhaps the Emperor will summon you for specific tasks. You will be notified when you are needed. Looking disappointed, Dorothea departed with a formal bow, and Emperor Salvador sat back in his throne. He had a long day ahead of him, many decisions to make, many visitors to greet, as was his duty. But there were other duties, and he was daydreaming that he might visit the Empress in her bedchamber that evening instead of his concubines, and for a specific purpose. Yes, Salvador decided. It was about time he had children of his own. Just to spite Rakella's version of the sisterhood and her monstrous bloodline predictions. That evening, as Salvador endured a banquet beside Empress Tabrina, as usual, he felt that his life was returning to normal. But that did not mean it was good. Looking across the table, he observed Roderick and his wife and their well-behaved children as they all shared desserts with each other. Editha picked up a small pastry, took a bite, and offered it to her daughter. Roderick laughed at some joke their boy had made, then leaned over and kissed his wife on the cheek. Salvador felt a deep sense of longing for what his younger brother had. He was the Emperor of the Imperium, thousands and thousands of worlds. Why couldn't he have a good family life? Why was that so difficult? He reached over hopefully, touched Tabrina's hand. She looked at him as if he had wiped excrement on her wrist. Don't touch me, she rasped. He withdrew, stung. Keeping his voice low, he protested, You're my empress. Why do you treat me this way? I'd be much warmer if you'd grant me a title and a government position. For many years I watched my father work his industries. I sat in his offices, learning from him. I have skills, and I would certainly be a better commerce minister than that idiot you've had in the position for 4 years. You dare to blackmail me? What blackmail? Tabrina arched her brows. I am only doing what women have done since time immemorial. You expect me to swoon over you when you treat me like a mere pet? I ask for a few perfectly reasonable duties, and you say no. I am the wronged party, not you. But I need a legitimate heir. The Imperium needs an heir. And I want to be Commerce Minister. She drew her arms close to her chest. The solution seems obvious enough. So, if I give you that title, you'll carry my child. Give me the title and the duties. Then, yes, I will invite you to my bedchamber on a specified schedule. Beyond that, I have no control over whether or not I get pregnant. Salvador narrowed his eyes. But you'll do nothing to prevent it. I'll do nothing to prevent it. She softened her expression a bit. And I think you'll find the arrangement far more pleasant, because I'll be happier with the new status. Just don't expect me to love you. No, I would never expect that, Salvador said, looking again at the happy couple of Roderick and Haditha. Dorothea slipped the vial into the new concubine's soft, lotioned hand. It is a cream, easily applied. Emperor Salvador will never notice, provided you keep his mind elsewhere. Angelina smiled stiffly. But, Reverend Mother, are you sure he won't feel it? Won't know? We've formulated this very carefully. A single exposure should be sufficient to render him sterile. He won't know anything has changed, won't even suspect he has a problem for a long time. And it won't harm you, either. The strikingly beautiful girl bowed. My concern is not for myself, but for the sisterhood. If you do this one thing, you will help ensure our future. Dorothea darted away down the dark hallway outside of the concubine's quarters. Despite her dispute with Reverend Mother Rakella, Dorothea had studied the breeding projection herself. Even though computers were inherently evil, she could not deny their accuracy. She felt a responsibility to prevent the most terrible tyrant in all of history from being inflicted on humanity. Each person mourns the loss of a comrade in his own way. But whatever the flowery eulogy, the dead remain dead. Zensuni saying. When he made his way back to the isolated weather station and the flying craft the twins had landed there, Vor knelt for a long while on the warm sand beside the body of Griffin Harkonnen. The young man's death was as utterly useless and heartbreaking as Ashanti's had been. Griffin might have been the best hope for restoring the fortunes and respect of House Harkonnen. His skills had been solid and his plans viable, but all had been snuffed out. Vor's enemies kept following him and causing him pain, always missing the true target, and so many innocents had paid the price for that debt. Even Mariella. He wrapped Griffin's body in a thin polymer tarpaulin that he found among the supplies inside the weather station. He could have just left the young man there. The elements would take care of him soon enough. But Vor found that dishonorable. Griffin Harkonnen had defeated him in a duel, held a sharp knife to his throat, and then granted Vorian his life back. Vor owed him a debt for that. But even more, Vor had to pay a debt to House Harkonnen. Not to make excuses, not to explain, but to acknowledge the disgrace and suffering he had heaped on Abelard's innocent descendants. And Abelard himself had been shaped by the disgrace that Vor had allowed to tarnish Xavier Harkonnen's name. Yes, the repercussions came back to him. He took a deep breath and reconsidered, but only a little. Xavier and Abelard and Griffin had been responsible for themselves. Vor harbored no illusions about that. But he too bore, and now accepted some of the blame. After tying the tarpaulin around the body, Vor lifted the young man over his shoulder and boarded the flyer, setting the wrapped package behind the cockpit seats. With the plodding thoroughness of a dirge, he completed the checklist, started the engines, and lifted away from the rocky bowl. The flyer was a common Arrakis model. The compass, weather sat linkage, and navigation charts guided him back to Arrakis City. Early that afternoon, he landed at the edge of the main spaceport and set about trying to find a carrier to transport Griffin's corpse back to Lankavale, along with a message to his family that he still had to write. The cargo line operators were baffled by his request. One asked, "Do you realize the expense, sir? Shipping a human body across space is not cost-effective." "I don't care about the cost. He belongs with his family, his oceans, and his home. I need to send him back there." Vor would have to arrange for a transfer of funds from one of his accounts on another planet, but the actual expense was not an issue. He could have ignored the responsibility, brushed the Harkonnens aside again, and turned his back on the guilt. But that sort of thinking had already caused too many problems. The cargo operator shook his head.
"I've seen fools waste their money in many ways. I advise you against this, but I know someone else will take your payment if I don't."
He accepted the job. Vor also felt obligated to give Griffin's family an explanation, though not too much. He wrote the message while the men handled the body. "Griffin Harkonnen died with honor, upholding his principles. This was a brave man, traveling the Imperium, never shirking his noble quest. He found me, as his family demanded of him, and we resolved our differences. In time, we might even have become friends, but he met an unexpected and tragic death. Now, in the spirit of his memory, I can only hope his family will understand and forgive." Vor paused, deciding not to reveal the existence of Agamemnon's other two children to Griffin's family. That matter was resolved, and the twins would cause no further harm. However, it was a battle the Harkonnens should never have needed to fight. "He was killed by desert bandits," Vor continued, "and I killed them for doing it. Your brave Griffin is avenged, and I join you in sorrow. I knew Griffin for only a short time, but I came to admire him, and I assure you, he earned the lasting respect of his family name." Vor finished what he had to say, and after Arrakis City morticians sealed and preserved the body, he placed the letter in a message compartment on the airtight storage container and watched as it was loaded onto the next outbound cargo ship. Eventually, it would be transferred to Lankavale. After the ship was gone, Vorian remained in Arrakis City for 3 days, but soon he came to realize that nothing was left for him there, and with Mariella now gone, he could not imagine returning to Kepler. He would only expose the rest of his family to great risk. There were 13,000 planets in the Imperium. Surely he could find someplace else to go. At the spaceport office, he offered his credentials, paid a substantial fee, and signed aboard a Venhold cargo ship that was due to depart with a load of melange. If he didn't have enough Solaris remaining in his accounts, he would work off his passage if necessary. For a while, he would fly the space lanes, or he might disembark on any world that interested him. The future for Vorian Atreides, however long he had, was an open, empty canvas. He boarded the ship, with no idea where it was bound, and did not look back at the desert planet.
Threats are only words, and have the detrimental effect of warning your opponent, which allows him to prepare a defense or offense. I don't believe in threats. I believe in hard, decisive action. Valia Harkonnen.
After the Sisterhood was outlawed on Rossak, Valia was sent back to Lankavale, against her will. She had been torn away from the jungle planet and herded onto a space transport with many other sisters, unable to ask Reverend Mother Raquella what to do or how she could help preserve the core of the sisterhood. Everything was lost. Her parents welcomed her back to the small, gloomy planet. It was the definition of home, she supposed, a place where family would take you in, no matter what shame or crisis you brought with you. Griffin still had not returned from his hunt for Vorian Atreides, but her little brother and sister were excited to see her. Her mother and father had kept her old room, and they pestered her with questions about the sisterhood. They weren't really interested, but were glad to have her back. Her mother had never believed that the special training would benefit Valya. From Valya's perspective, though, she had learned too much to simply sit back and resign herself to a quiet, unambitious life. She looked forward to Griffin returning home, when the two of them could make plans and take new paths to restoring the Harkonnens to prominence. Her hopes for advancement through the sisterhood, or through ties of friendship with Anna Carino, had all run aground. She remembered the Reverend Mother's words, "The sisterhood is your only family now." But the Order of Women no longer existed, and her own family seemed to have forgotten what it really meant to be a Harkonnen. They had made poor decisions, which led to their exile here on this wintry world of cold seas and rugged fjords. They failed to grasp the significance of political events beyond their own backwater planet. They continued to disappoint her. But Griffin had never let her down, and as days passed, she grew increasingly worried about him. If she could jump into the Arctic waters again to save him, she would. One morning, 2 weeks after her arrival, Valya entered the main living area of her parents' house. The fireplace was ablaze, and she could smell a pot of whale meat stew cooking in the kitchen, a family recipe seasoned with aromatic local spices and vegetables. She had never liked Lankavale cooking. Her father chatted at great length with Valya about making alterations to their house, using different roofing materials and better insulation. She had no interest whatsoever. As the planetary leader, Virgil Harkonnen made no attempt to advance the political position of House Harkonnen, and he merely shrugged when he received a notice that the Landsrod proxy for Lankavale had signed on to Manfred Tarondo's petition and publicly added support for the Butlerians. She sighed in dismay as she looked at her father now, sitting on a blocky wooden chair by the fire, engrossed in a book. In the time she'd been away, he had become a very small person. If House Harkonnen were ever to return to prominence and glory, it would be up to her and her brother. "Griffin, where are you?" she thought. Sonia Harkonnen sat at a small table where she used a thick needle and cord to sew pieces of whale fur together, making a new coat for Valya's younger brother, Danvis. The boy was 14 now, old enough to go out on fur whale expeditions. His features and mannerisms reminded her of Griffin at that age. Valya stood by the fire to warm herself. Every day since returning, she'd been chilled to the bone. She hadn't realized how warm and pleasant Rossack was in comparison. Her father greeted her pleasantly. "Good morning, Valya." Her mother followed with the same words, exactly, and her own vacuous smile. Valya couldn't wait to leave this place again. When Sister Arlette had recruited her on a windswept day down by the docks, the woman had described how the school on Rossack could be Valya's route to power and influence. But now the sisterhood was a wounded creature, looking for some place to heal or die. "We saved an omelet for you when you didn't come down for breakfast." Her mother gestured toward a covered warming dish on the hearth. Valya decided to take the food up to her room, where she could think about what to do next. She picked up the plate and had turned toward the wooden stairs when she heard an urgent rapping at the door. It was not a good sound. Her senses were immediately alert. Her father waved her off and went to answer the knock. He opened the heavy door to see two local fishermen bringing a delivery, an oblong package almost 2 meters long, stamped with 3 transfer labels from the Venhold spacing fleet.
"This was in the shuttle that arrived last night. We're still distributing."
Virgil thanked them, curious about the large package. Valya helped him pull it inside, but something about the size and shape of the container filled her with dread. Oblivious, her father poked at the labels to see if he could identify the sender's name, but Valya ignored a message compartment and tore at the packaging, peeling away the sheets of polymer. She was the first to see her brother's dead face, his eyes closed, his cheeks covered with a stubble of beard. His goatee was matted, and there was a tracing of dust on his forehead and in his brown hair. His head lolled at an odd angle. Shocked, her father stumbled backward and bumped into the wall, then began to sob. Her mother rushed forward to stare down at the body of her son. It was something parents should never have to see. Valya summoned all of the training that the sisterhood had given her. She had been taught how to study a situation in 100 instant snapshots from every vantage. She froze and stared, then threw herself on the makeshift casket. In a very quiet voice, she whispered her brother's name, knowing he could never answer her again. Griffin. The two fishermen who had delivered the package bowed their heads respectfully. One of them opened the message compartment and handed an envelope to Virgil Harkonnen.
This came too, sir. I'm very sorry, sir.
His partner handed over additional mail, and both of them stepped back. Distraught and sobbing, Virgil tore the first envelope open, and his shaking hands tore the paper letter as well, but he pushed the pieces back together so he could read the words. He seemed as incapable of understanding the message as he was of comprehending the death of his son.
It's from Vorian Atreides.
Valya grabbed the letter from him.
What? That bastard.
She read the message, knowing it would either be gloating or lies. Written in a firm script, the letter asserted that her brother had died a hero, trying to defend Vorian against attackers.
Nonsense.
Griffin had gone to assassinate him, not save him. This Atreides was implying that they were friends. It had to be a lie, a complete lie. Again, Vorian Atreides was sticking his thumb in the eyes of the Harkonnens. He killed my brother. Though she didn't know the circumstances of Griffin's death, Valya knew whom to hold responsible. It felt even more personal to her now, and her desire to kill him more just. Also in the mail delivered by the cargo ship was an ostentatious official document, signed, stamped, and sealed. A proclamation that Griffin Harkonnen had paid the requisite fees and passed all of the required examinations, and he had now been accepted as Lankavale's official planetary representative to the Landsraad. Valya tore it in two.
This vendetta will never end, she whispered to her brother's body. I will find Vorian Atreides.
She retreated to her room and locked the door. Her parents assumed she had gone to grieve. Instead, reaching into a pocket, she brought out a small packet containing a single capsule of the Rossack drug, a precisely measured portion she had taken from Sister Carrie's lab. It was identical to the one that Anna Carino had stolen and swallowed, the same dosage that had nearly killed her. Valya held the pill between her thumb and forefinger, staring at it, trying to summon the nerve to take the poison, which would either kill her or transform her. Previously, she had hesitated, worried that her death would cause irreparable harm to Harkonnen ambitions. But now she felt exactly the opposite. If she could become a reverend mother, with full control and precise access to her cellular chemistry and to the memory lives of all her female ancestors back to the dawn of time, then she would be unstoppable. Valya could envision numerous ways to hunt down and destroy Vorian Atreides. The voices of her other memories would guide her. She closed her eyes and swallowed the pill.
Setbacks can send you reeling off course, or they can make you stronger. Reverend Mother Rakella,
address to the Sisterhood. The Venhold shuttle descended through a clear sky toward a planet that was chilly, but still hospitable to life. A new sanctuary, a place where Sioba assured them no one could look. Even before Venport's assistance, Rakella had developed a secret contingency survival plan, working closely with Kerry Marquis. The Sisterhood's funds in off-world escrow accounts had now been absorbed by the Venhold banking system. It was a tight alliance Rakella had not expected to make, but she could see the value. Accompanied by 28 ragtag followers that she had surreptitiously gathered, Rakella had high hopes for this scouting mission. If this world proved acceptable, she had made arrangements to rendezvous with additional sisters who remained loyal to her. With luck, the Venhold spacing fleet would deliver them all here. The old woman felt an obligation to each and every one of them. Those women had made vows of allegiance to her. She needed to get her new base of operations selected as soon as possible, and then begin contacting them, rebuilding her school. Wallach 9 had been one of the synchronized worlds under the control of Omnius, ruled for a time by the human traitor Yorek Thur, and then destroyed by the army of the Jihad in a nuclear attack a century ago. Most of the radiation had died down by now, and the planet was potentially habitable by humans. Venport assured the Reverend Mother that no commercial ships ever visited there. The shuttle settled down on an old machine landing field that had survived the Holocaust. A number of stone warehouse buildings surrounded the field, some of them collapsed. In the distance, Rakella saw sparse forests and a line of snow-covered peaks. Ice on nearby hills sparkled in the dim light of the blue-white sun Laojin. Though the projections suggested that this planet had a typically cold and rainy climate, Wallach 9 seemed to be showing off its natural beauty to the best effect. She bundled up in a thick coat and stepped off the shuttle ramp onto the cracked pavement. As the other sisters disembarked and walked toward the nearest building, Rakella felt a sharp, cold wind that seemed to cut through her skin. This was quite a different environment from the humid jungles of Rossak. Dark clouds closed in and spat down a wind-driven torrent of rain, drenching the women before they could reach cover. "Director Venport assures us this place is safe. I think we've found our new homeworld." Rakella shivered in the shadows of the warehouse. Here, on this distant, rugged planet, she would gather as many sisters as possible and continue their training in secret. For now, her trainees had the goal of merely surviving. But soon, the Sisterhood would accomplish much more than that.
We hope you've enjoyed Sisterhood of Dune, a Macmillan audio production from Tor Books. Text copyright 2011 by Herbert Properties LLC. Production copyright 2011 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.